From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Anagraff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank's guest is writer and popular podcaster Matt Frad, author of The Porn Myth, exposing the reality behind the fantasy of pornography. Due to the subject matter of this particular broadcast, listener discretion is advised. Let's now join Hank as he introduces Matt Frad.
And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that brings to you some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. Today is no exception. My guest, Matt Frad, he is a speaker, a podcaster, and he's an author of a very significant book. In fact, I read it this week with great interest, and I thought this is a book that everyone needs to read. It's called The Porn Myth, and exposes the reality behind the fantasy of pornography. I've often said that pornography is an enslaving addiction. It's a violation of marriage vows, and it's a precursor to increasingly dangerous and degrading sexual practices. And all of that is borne out in this book. Again, the title, The Porn Myth, Exposing the Reality Behind the Fantasy of Pornography. Matt has a lot of interesting things to say. We'll talk about this and a whole lot more on today's edition of Hank Unplugged. Matt, it is great to have you with me.
G'day, Hank. It's lovely to be on the podcast. You know, the first time I heard of you, because being a Catholic, I wasn't in your orbit for a while. The first time I heard of you was that radio debate you did between James White and Jimmy Akin.
Oh, wow.
I used to work for Catholic Answers as an apologist, and so that's when I first came across you. So it's an honor to hear from you and an honor to be invited to be on the podcast.
Well, I was just on Catholic Answers maybe a month or so ago, and
cool.
We're talking about my conversion to Orthodoxy.
Well, I'm an Eastern Catholic, so I go to a Byzantine Catholic church, and so the liturgy is almost identical. You pray for the Patriarch, we pray for Francis.
Yeah, well, you're not far from the truth, Matt. You're getting there.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. One step at a time.
one step at a time. I loved your book. I mean, I've been talking about this for years, but there was so much in the book that I simply did not understand. And I'm sure if I didn't understand some of the things in the book, a lot of other people are in the same boat.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you liked it. It took about 4 years to write, research, and edit. And it's a non-religious response to pro-porn arguments, as you know, so anyone could hand this to a friend who isn't necessarily religious, and I just tried to lay out the arguments as best I could with a lot of the scientific findings that have been coming out of academia for the last 40 or so years.
And you sort of wrote the book in a question-answer format, so there are a lot of myths that are addressed in the book.
Yeah, so there's about 30 to 40 myths that I tried to rack my brain to come up with. What is it that people say when they try to justify a porn use? You know, they might say something like, well, it's liberating for women, or it's, you know, it's not addictive anyway. It's just a bit of fun, and as long as you don't go overboard, or it doesn't really impact the brain. Maybe anime porn, cartoon porn might be okay, those sorts of things. Maybe masturbation's okay, and then I just, yeah, sort of like in Thomas Aquinas fashion, tried to present the arguments for that position and then showed why they don't work. And that if anyone is pro-science and pro-love, that's a good reason to be anti-porn. So I'm not first inviting people to embrace the truths of the Christian faith before they reject porn. I'm saying you've got good reason to want to reject it now.
You're also co-creator of Victory, which is an app that provides a strategic battle plan for winning the struggle against pornography. You're into this subject, and I think for good reason. I've often said that if you think about pornography, you think about this not as a sort of a niche issue. This is a macro issue. If you think of all of the strategic issues of life, marriage is at the apex, and this is something that devolves the marriage bound.
Right. I thought about this the other day. You know, Marvel doesn't have a great time coming up with villains, and so I have an idea for Marvel. They construct a character who seeks to destroy civilization by destroying the fundamental building blocks of that civilization by perverting the act proper to, you know, the marriage bed. Because once sex goes, so does marriage. And once marriage goes, so does the family. And once family goes, so goes civilization. And so if it seems that Christians are spending a lot of time talking about sex, it's for good reason. Because if sex isn't sacred, what action is, you know? And yeah, once that gets perverted, so does the culture. Have a look around us. I just saw this tweet today of some mother, you know, celebrating the fact that her second grader in a public school was educating us all on the, you know, LGBTQ stuff. And I just thought, this is insanity. And it all, yeah, we pervert sex. That's how it all unfolds, I think.
You know, just about the time that people are talking about pornography as being something that is settling, that is maybe even helpful to society, you come along and you say, absolutely not. This is one of the most perverse practices imaginable. So society, by and large, seems to be ratifying pornography. You're saying exactly the opposite.
Right. And what's actually been quite exciting and something that gives me optimism is that there are a lot of people in the culture now who are speaking out against pornography. Right, like Pamela Anderson, James Hetfield, the lead singer of Metallica, just narrated an anti-porn documentary. Comedian Chris Rock spoke openly about how porn just led to his divorce. We can actually go on and on. It's kind of exciting that, you know, there's these big secular groups online. My friend Alexander Rhodes runs the website nofap.com. There are over 200,000 people within that forum on Reddit, most of whom aren't religious. But they would just like to have a more interesting life, please. They would like to have sexual function back, which pornography has taken away. And so I'm, you know, speaking at conferences alongside Mormons, Marxist, atheist, feminist professors, all sorts of people who we might disagree about many things. But the one thing we all agree on is that the world would be better without sexual exploitation. So it's kind of exciting to see.
I like what you've written in saying that the real problem with pornography isn't that it shows too much, but it shows too little of the human person. Expand on that.
Right. So the problem with porn isn't nudity. The human body is what is the human body? It expresses the mystery of the human person. It's not an animate provider of pleasure like a steak or a keg of beer, right? It's, you know, we don't inhabit our bodies, we are our bodies. And so to exploit the body is to exploit the person. If the body were worthless, you couldn't degrade it. You know, when you say you degraded her or him, that presupposes that she or he had some grade to begin with. And so it's precisely because the body is good that porn is wicked, right? The same thing with sex. Like, sex is good. If it wasn't, you couldn't make it ugly. You can't make mud ugly. And sexual desire is good. Well, whose idea was it anyway, right? I mean, God, in the first commandment to humanity, Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, he says, be fruitful and multiply. And I don't think he meant grow grapefruits and invent calculators. He meant have sex and fill the world. So it's precisely because sex is so powerful and beautiful and good that sexual desire is too, that nudity is. I mean, this is why I love taking my children to museums. I want them to see beautiful naked art that expresses the mystery of the person. But porn doesn't do that, you see. For all of its exposure, porn always ends up suppressing and obfuscating the mystery, the personhood of the performer. You know, I don't care about her thoughts or her dreams or her past or what happened to her when she was young, or all of that would get in the way of what I'm attempting to do here. In a sense, and this might sound a little hyperbolic, but I think there's a point here. In a sense, porn does what death does. It separates with knife-like precision the mind, the person, the soul, however you want to put it, and the body. You think of a Playboy centerfold or something like that. You know, she doesn't have to be alive. It doesn't matter to me. I don't care about her. And it seems to me if there was ever a behavior in which you were to engage in where the personhood of the other should be recognized and affirmed, it ought to be the marital embrace. And that's precisely what isn't affirmed in pornography. And that's why it's so, you know, it's so ghastly. But I mean, all of that said, I don't want people listening thinking that I'm coming down hard on them.
because pornography feels great. It's very pleasurable. It makes me feel powerful, masculine, strong, in control. And of course, many young women struggle with pornography, and they might say something like, well, it makes me feel desired. It makes me feel pleasurable. Sometimes we can only begin to overcome something when we admit we like doing it. I remember hearing of an alcoholic who said he was only able to begin to break free of alcoholism when he admitted that he loved getting drunk, but that it was killing him. And so he had to make a choice. So I think we have to be honest about the worm on the end of the hook, as it were, the thing we go after, the thing we get from it, but then very soberly admit that we don't want to be these sorts of people. Like, I don't want to be the kind of husband who has to creep away from my wife late at night to have an intimate encounter with my iPhone. I don't want to have to diligently delete my history file so my kids don't find out dad's a porn addict. That isn't the sort of person I want to be. I don't want to be remembered as the guy, you know, who consumed this much porn every day. Even if the church had nothing to say on the matter and, you know, the scriptures had nothing to say on the matter, it's just not who I want to be. I want my life to be good and true and beautiful, and I want my sex life to be good and true and beautiful. And it seems to me, and all the research seems to be backing this up, that if you want to be sexually dissatisfied, then pornography is the way to go. That's what leads to sexual ugliness and falseness. And, well, there you go. I'm ranting now. But
no, you're not. I mean, I love what you're talking about. And I was thinking as you were talking, Matt, that my good friend Joe Dallas, he lived the gay lifestyle for many, many years. And I don't know of anybody on the planet today that knows more about that subject and delivers it in a more compassionate, compelling way than Joe Dallas. And I was thinking about some similarities with you in that you're not talking about something that you don't know anything about. You've experienced this from an early age. You know precisely how it enslaves, and therefore there's a passion that comes out in your speaking and your writing. It's not like you're ranting or rambling. I mean, you are passionate and for good reason.
Well, thank you. I hope it's a coherent rant, if nothing else. That's right. I mean, I like almost every male on the planet, you know, has seen pornography. And when I was 12 and 13, my best friend's mum, he was a single child and she wasn't married, she would buy us porn. She'd drive us down to the movie store. She'd buy us VHS tapes and even buy us hard liquor. And so at the age of 12, here we are drinking vodka, pretending to like it, watching porn. That was me at 12 and 13 and 14 and 15. My parents had no idea about it. This was before the time of the internet. So that was just the world I was immersed in. I never felt comfortable with it. I liked doing it, but I always felt sort of like that this wasn't particularly masculine behavior. It wasn't until I was 17 years old and encountered the person of Jesus Christ that I decided I didn't want to live like this and that I shouldn't be living like this, and thus began the long road to recovery. And of course, recovery isn't something that happens in an instant. It's not something that happens to you. And I think too often we treat recovery like that. Well, when will I be free? But of course, as Christians, our goal is heaven, and sexual purity is part of the fuel, right, that's going to help us get there, if you want to put it that way. But it's better, I think, to think of recovery as a daily choice that I make by my actions.
And I think that when you think about the Christian life, it's not just heaven at the end of the rainbow. It's Christ came to give us life that is life to the full in the present. And if you're engaging in these behaviors, there's something that happens to your soul. There's something that is so dissatisfying,
yes,
and debilitating in the present that you can't experience life that's life to the full.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And this is one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this topic. Like, I feel like one of the things that prevents the seed of the gospel to penetrate the hearts of men and women, but yeah, part of that is that they are up to their eyeballs in degrading pornography. I mean, how long can one keep within one's mind the human person is a good towards which the only proper and adequate attitude is love, and at the same time subject myself to, you know, body-punishing, women-hating porn? I mean, I'm not going to be detailed here, but if people are listening and they haven't seen pornography since, you know, the 80s, it's something very different. You know, like today, most porn sites have rape categories and shame categories, and this is the first thing children are exposed to, not the whole Playboy centerfold thing that we might remember from our youth. And so, yeah, it's one of those obstacles, I think, to the reception of the gospel. And that's why I'm passionate about it.
And it really rewires the brain as well. I mean, I thought that was one of the great insights in the book. I mean, it's not new, but you have certainly hammered home the point that there's neuroplasticity in the brain and that pornography actually ends up, in a very technical sense, rewiring our anatomy in that capacity.
Right. And this isn't scare tactics. This isn't hyperbole. This is what the data is showing. So as I sit here, I believe there are 39 peer-reviewed neuroscience-based studies on porn users. And every one of them supports the addiction model. Now, I know people, especially in the Christian community, might feel a little uncomfortable with that term, addiction, because they might think it's a word that people use to escape culpability or that it's overused. And I agree with that. But just because something can be abused doesn't mean it can't be used appropriately. But what we are seeing is all sorts of things.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with author Matt Fradd. An increasingly accepted belief in today's popular culture says that pornography is a harmless or even beneficial pastime. Author Matt Fradd draws on the experience of porn performers and users and the expertise of neurologists, sociologists, and psychologists to demonstrate that pornography is destructive to individuals and society. To receive your copy of The Porn Myth, Exposing the Reality Behind the Fantasy of Pornography as Our Appreciation for Your Financial Partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or visit equip.org. We'll be back in just a moment with more on The Bible Answer Man. Increasingly, Western culture embraces confusion as a virtue and decries certainty as a sin. Those who are confused about sexuality and identity are viewed as heroes. Those who are confused about morality are progressive pioneers. Conversely, those who express certainty about any of these issues are seen as bigoted and intolerant. In Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World, Abdu Murray responds to the confusion by offering gospel clarity that can touch the hearts and minds of those in our post-truth culture. To receive your copy of Saving Truth as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. There is a mysterious resonance among the structure of the material world, the abstract world of mathematics, and the human mind. This three-part harmony has major implications for the contemporary debate between naturalism and theism. The sciences alone, however, are insufficient to illuminate this enigma. Other topics include The Handmaid's Tale, Human Dignity and Hope. Slaughterhouse-Five is a tool for Christian self-examination. Redeeming Princess Culture, Five Apologetics Lessons from the Writings of Martin Luther King Jr., and much, much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today at the new discounted rate by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
With over 500,000 copies in print, Hank Hanegraaff's Bible Answer books were born out of his many years of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. He's taken his on-air answers to questions and chiseled them until only the gems emerge. Questions involving biblical interpretation, cults, science, ethics, apparent contradictions, and much more. This remarkable collection of concise answers is now even better. My goal, says Hank, is to take the complex and make it simple and memorable. Receive your copy of the complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated, as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. Welcome back to the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. On today's edition, we're presenting an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Did you know that pornography is neurologically addictive? Are you able to separate the myths from the facts about pornography? Matt Frad offers real help to the parents and spouses of porn users in his book, The Porn Myth, exposing the reality behind the fantasy of pornography. To receive your copy of The Porn Myth as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-transforming outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Let's now rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Matt Frad, in their conversation.
I believe there are 39 peer-reviewed neuroscience-based studies on porn users, and every one of them supports the addiction model. There was a study that came out in 2014 from the Max Planck Institute in Germany. It's like the Harvard of Germany, and they discovered that to the degree in which one was looking at pornography, there were smaller parts of his brain. Your brain becomes desensitized, so you feel you have to continually watch more deviant forms of pornography to feel normal. This leads to all sorts of things like anxiety and erectile dysfunction and premature ejaculation and all of this. I mean, if you've been wondering why you've been seeing more commercials for Viagra lately, there might be a good reason for that. And again, this isn't a scare tactic come up with by some Christian group. These are people like Dr. Abraham Morgenthaler, who's the clinical urologist at Harvard Medical School, or Dr. Norman Doidge, who wrote the book The Brain That Changes Itself. You know, these aren't Christian people, but they're saying, without a doubt, we're seeing a huge spike in erectile dysfunction in young men because their brains have become accustomed to pixels on a screen that they don't know how to interact with a real-life person. And so you might get married one day only to discover that it's not working because you've burnt your brain out on this stuff. So that's real. That's scary, and it should be scary, and it's bloody well true. There's my friend Gary Wilson. He's an atheist. He runs the website yourbrainonporn.com. It's a great website in which it compiles all the data coming out of academia that you can go read for yourself. Again, not science fiction, science. And for this reason, more people are turning against porn. It's sort of like the tobacco apologists back in the 90s who tried to tell us that there was no connection between smoking and cancer. You say that today, and any teenager is going to laugh at you or think you're joking. Something similar is happening. You know, I think the culture is beginning to turn against porn because when everybody is either themselves addicted to porn, struggling with porn to some capacity and sees their negative effects, or loves somebody who does, it becomes more and more difficult to believe the worn-out mantra from the porn industry that this is just, you know, fine behavior for well-rounded adults and don't get carried away and so forth. It's just a joke.
Did you grow up in the Aussie culture?
Yeah. Yep.
What's that like? I mean, if you compare it to America, I mean, you compare Europe to America, oftentimes people will tell you Europe is far down the track from where we are. Is that true of the Australian culture?
I suppose it depends on what you mean. I mean, if you're talking about sort of socialism or sort of liberal culture, or I'm not sure what you might mean. I think that the internet leveled the playing field somewhat. So perhaps prior to the internet, there was more true Australian culture. Since the internet came in, it kind of feels like we're all becoming a sort of monolithic blob. I don't even know if it's a culture anymore. Just if culture means life shared in common, I'm not sure we have that. Getting drunk on New Year's Eve and having a hangover the next day isn't much of a culture, but I'm being pessimistic. I'm sorry. It's similar. It's similar, especially in regard to pornography. I mean, Australians, I'm sure, no doubt consume pornography at the same rate per capita as Americans do.
What is the sense of having a relationship with God in any sense, like in Australia as opposed to here? Same thing? Pretty similar?
Yeah. Yeah, it's much more secular, I think you'd say, than America. Like, I believe there are still Walmarts that you could walk into that would sell Christian t-shirts. That's absolutely not a thing in Australia. So certainly we'd be more secular in that sense. But there are pockets of tremendous hope in Australia. So, I mean, I think the evangelical church is growing. There's a lot of signs of hope in the Catholic and Orthodox churches. And, you know, as society becomes increasingly anti-Christian, in my estimation, it seems like we're either going to have to regain what we have and stop allowing the culture to chip away at it and make compromises with it, or just sort of become consumed by it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we're living in a time in which the culture is conforming Christians to their presuppositions as opposed to Christians being salt and light. I've often said that the problem is not the culture. Pagans are going to do what pagans do. That's their job description. What else would they do? The problem is that Christians aren't being salt and light, that they're not leavening the culture. So I think it's cool to hear what you said about Australia. That's exactly what I presumed in talking to friends of mine that are Australian. It's a more secular culture, but there are signs that the secular culture can't carry the day, and now Christians are starting to have an impact there that's quite significant.
Right. I really feel like Christians need to return to natural law if they want to put forth a coherent position, because secularism isn't coherent. I mean, even if you consider abortion, it's ridiculous. I mean, is it wrong for big, strong people to kill little, weak, innocent people or not? And if it's not, what does wrong mean? And if it is, how can you keep justifying it? You know, and I think it's sad for me when I see Christians usually in Protestant denominations who seem to be caving on issues that are foundational. But of course, because they've got, and I'd love your take on this, maybe we disagree strongly here, I'm not sure, but because they rely on sola scriptura, they say, well, it doesn't say anything about, you know, masturbation in scripture, or it doesn't say anything about homosexual acts, or it does, but we can explain them away. And, you know, without basing our understanding of scripture in natural law.
Yeah, and also having some historical context within which to think. I mean, people, when they think about Christian history, they think maybe back 40 or 50 years, maybe they think back to the Reformation, but they really don't know what the early Christian church believed in all these matters. So I think being not only biblical, but historically
literate. Right, like if the church fathers, let's say, were unanimous on a particular moral position, and now we've all abandoned it, that should cause us pause, to say the least.
Yeah, and particularly in the fact that most people don't know what the church fathers said, if they know what the church fathers were. So I couldn't agree with you more. I think one of the big problems is that people, it's not only sola scriptura, it's solo scriptura. You know, maybe a play on words, but it's me and my Bible. It's not exactly what the definition is denotatively, but I think about people, me and my Bible, and
Cut off from a tradition.
From a tradition, absolutely. And as a result of that, we have all kinds of problems. So people look at Roman Catholics as though Catholics have a crass system of works righteousness, or Orthodox as being a religion to be cursed because, again, a crass system of works righteousness, where in reality, neither Orthodoxy nor Catholicism is a crass system of righteousness, nor do Catholics and Orthodox people put one up against the other, as though.
Right, and sorry.
Keep no, going. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I agree with that, and I feel like I'm a big fan of the Benedict option when it's understood the way it was intended to be understood, not when it's misrepresented. And so, I'm a big fan of ecumenism, and rather than sort of criticizing my Christian brothers and sisters who might be separated from the Catholic Church, I'm more interested in inviting them to embrace things like natural law, not telling them to become Catholic yet, although, of course, as a Catholic, I would want that. But just, you know, we need to be banding together here against an insane culture. It's like we're in an insane asylum, and those in charge have gone insane, and there are a few people who are hanging on to sanity. That might sound a little self-congratulatory, but I don't really care. I think it's true. And it's like we kind of got to bind together here, as Peter Kraft put it, when a maniac is at the door, feuding brothers reconcile. I like that.
No, I think it's absolutely true. I mean, you think about Benjamin Franklin saying that if we don't hang together, we're all going to hang separately. And so I think the fusion that needs to take place in the Christian church is oftentimes outside the purview of most Christians. It has to happen. I'm not saying that we have to get rid of all of our distinctives, but we have to recognize that we have a oneness within the context of the essentials of the historic Christian faith. That's why the mantra of our ministry is in essentials unity, non-essentials liberty, and all things charity.
Augustine. Absolutely. And this is why I can have more in common with an evangelical Protestant than some liberal Catholic, because he's more faithful to Catholicism than the Catholic is.
Yeah, absolutely.
In some respects, yeah. Anyway, we've gone far afield, haven't we?
No, well, let's get back to pornography for my interesting conversation. Pornography oftentimes is not understood from a denotative perspective, but when you understand it from a denotative perspective, when you understand the etymology of the word, things begin to change in your mind very quickly.
Right. Yeah, etymology can be helpful sometimes. Pornography comes from two Greek words, porne graphpane, which means loosely the writing or perhaps drawing of the prostitutes. That graphpane, so we get the word graffiti and calligraphy, those sorts of things. So that's what it means. Now, what would be a decent definition of it? This is a shorthand one, which may not be perfect, but I think is not bad. You might say pornography is material which depicts erotic behavior which is in either intended to sexually arouse or by and large has that effect, you know. And so if that's a good enough working definition, then you can say things like, is 50 Shades of Stupid, you know, material which depicts erotic behavior, however poorly written, intended to sexually arouse? And I think the obvious answer is yes. But there might be some instances where we're not sure. I'm not pretending it's always black and white, but you know, I think most of the cases we do know when it is pornography, and that's my basic definition. What do you think?
Well, you've also pointed out that it entered the English language in the mid-19th century.
Right.
And that the meaning has to do with prostitution.
Right. So pornography is meant to serve an erotic function like a prostitute is. So, and here's a good way to put it, right? Like, if you went to a porn producer, porn director after a screening of their latest flick, say, I'm not sure if they have them, and you were to say, hey, great film, really lovely, love the dialogue, very good, you know, and he'd look at you like, uh-huh. And you kept going on about, you know, how lovely the music was, the music score, and at some point he might look at you quizzically and say, good, did it get you off? And if you looked at him and said, goodness, no, are you serious? I'm sorry, what are you talking about? The porn director would think you were making fun of him because his clear goal was to produce something that served an erotic function like that of a prostitute. You know, similarly, if you went to Michelangelo or someone else painting nudes and said, wow, that's really getting me turned on here, he might question your psychological health or worry that his paintings had that effect. So I think the goal is to get the intention of the artist and the intention of the viewer in sync with the dignity of the human person. Because at the end of the day, porn isn't created for the sake of beauty, and art isn't created for the sake of masturbation. I think you could probably boil it down that way.
A lot of people listening in might be thinking, you know what, Matt is all too graphic with his language. We got to make sure kids are not in the room hearing what he has to say. But I think you'd say probably exactly the opposite. I mean, kids are exposed to this at a very, very early age, and therefore we better wake up and smell the coffee.
Right. So I think I'd say yes and no. I mean, I think parents are clearly the primary educators of their children, and it ought to be them, not some random Australian explaining these things to them. So I'm very sympathetic to that. The last thing we want to do is scandalize our children. We know what Christ said about those who would scandalize these little ones.
We'll pick up Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with author and podcaster Matt Fratt in just a few moments. The Bible Answer Man broadcast and CRI's growing array of outreaches have never been more needed than they are today. And that's why we won't be shy in asking you to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Christian Research Institute through your persistent prayers and generous financial support. Stand with Hank Hanegraaff and CRI in the battle for life and truth, and as thanks for your gift, receive a copy of Matt Fratt's book, The Porn Myth, exposing the reality behind the fantasy of pornography. Simply call 888-7000-CRI
and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. We'll be back after the break with more of this special edition of the Bible Answer Man. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive collection of the most often asked as well as most difficult questions Hank Hanegraaff has received in nearly three decades of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. This expanded edition contains new entries, leading readers to a better understanding of God and our relationship to Him in Jesus Christ. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive, handy, and attractive volume that you will return to again and again. Take your exploration of God's Word to new heights and receive the Revised and Updated Complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. Many feminists see the warped value system portrayed in Hulu's The Handmaid's Tale as a reflection of Christian and social conservative ideologies. In reality, the dominant secular worldview, with its idolization of sexual freedom and rejection of intrinsic human dignity, fosters in the actual world the very oppression seen in the series. Other topics include how the structure and comprehensibility of the universe reveal a mindful maker, five apologetics lessons from the writings of Martin Luther King Jr., kindergartners need apologetics too, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today at the new discounted rate by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
Increasingly, Western culture embraces confusion as a virtue and decries certainty as a sin. Those who are confused about sexuality and identity are viewed as heroes. Those who are confused about morality are progressive pioneers. Conversely, those who express certainty about any of these issues are seen as bigoted and intolerant. In Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World, Abdu Murray responds to the confusion by offering gospel clarity that can touch the hearts and minds of those in our post-truth culture. To receive your copy of Saving Truth as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. You've tuned in to a special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. Pornography is a pervasive problem in our culture that affects all of us. In his book, The Porn Myth, Matt Frad provides insightful, non-religious arguments, supported by the latest scientific research to discredit the fanciful claims used to defend and promote pornography. To receive your copy of The Porn Myth, Exposing the Reality Behind the Fantasy of Pornography as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Let's now rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Matt Frad.
A lot of people listening in might be thinking, you know what, Matt is all too graphic with his language. We got to make sure kids are not in the room. But I think you'd say probably exactly the opposite. I mean, kids are exposed to this at a very, very early age, and therefore we better wake up and smell the coffee.
Right. So I think I'd say yes and no. I mean, I think parents are clearly the primary educators of their children, and it ought to be them, not some random Australian, explaining these things to them. So I'm very sympathetic to that. The last thing we want to do is scandalize our children We know what Christ said about those who would scandalize these little ones. That said, I am of the opinion that we ought to begin talking to our children about the age of six about what pornography is. And that's because at the age of six, they're either given a tablet or they use it at a friend's house or they use it at school. And so they're very likely to come across something pornographic. And we don't need to scandalize them. We can just say something like this. You know, if somebody shows you or if you ever see pictures or videos of people who are showing parts of their body that their bathing suit should cover, you should always tell mommy and daddy, and we'd be very proud of you for doing that. You might think you'd be in trouble, but you wouldn't be. We'd actually be very proud of you. And you might say, well, that's what pornography is. And use that word, too. So, you know, I've been in stores and my son has pointed at, you know, Sports Illustrated or something and said, Dad, is that pornography? I went, yeah, pretty much. And one of the corporal works of mercy is to clothe the naked. So why don't we turn these around here for the poor people and for this woman's dignity, you know? But I don't think that conversation should come out of the blue. It should be built upon an ongoing conversation that we have with our children about the goodness of their bodies and why they ought to treat them with reverence and look upon other people with reverence, you know? And that's why I'd say I'd recommend, you know, having a beautiful painting of the breastfeeding Madonna in one's house or something like that to, you know, to show the beauty of breasts and what they're for and, you know, the even naked art, you know, Michelangelo's David or something. There's a way in which the human body can be depicted that does justice to the person.
The internet. I mean, you think about the numbers of people that are becoming addicted to pornography and earlier on. The statistics that I read in your book are simply mind-blowing. 63% of men, 21% of women. We did an article, by the way, in the Christian Research Journal about the increasing addiction to pornography of women.
Right. Yeah. And so that's I'm glad you brought that up. Unfortunately, for the longest time, I think many of us have been saying things like porn is a guy's issue. Girls are more into romance novels. And I do think that there's some truth to that. I don't know how many men went out and bought 50 Shades of Grey. But that said, I'm finding that comment increasingly alienating to those that I speak to. If I got up in front of a high school crowd and said men are more visual than women, I think it just wouldn't resonate with a lot of women. And I think many women look at pornography, and young girls do too, and in a way that wasn't the case back in the 80s and 90s. And part of that is because they were exposed to porn when they were like seven, and they should have found it interesting. That's the thing. If your kid's normal, he or she should find sex interesting. And if he sees pornography, he'll find within himself a cauldron of emotions, like arousal, maybe disgust, maybe, you know, pleasure or curiosity. That's all normal. And if we haven't educated our children about what porn is, what to do when they see it, or we haven't locked down our devices with things like Covenant Eyes, which is the best accountability and filter on the web, then they're going to see it. And they might not bring it up to us, but they might go back to it from time to time. And it'll become like a pacifier that they turn to when they feel emotionally turbulent, to try and settle themselves in the way perhaps you and I did when we were teens. We'd call up a friend on the house phone, and if we couldn't get through to them, we called another friend. If we couldn't get through to them, we'd call another friend. What we were doing is trying to sort of settle or regulate our emotional affect. We wouldn't have used that language, of course, but today we can train ourselves from a young age to pacify, to settle our emotional turbulence with a screen and with pornography, and that can be a really dangerous thing.
Yeah, that's another issue that you've touched on in your book, in fact, underscored pretty significantly, and that is that porn is oftentimes viewed as an aid to enhance intimacy. And I remember a quote from your book where you quote Dear Abby saying that couples can watch porn to spice up their sex lives as long as both individuals are comfortable with it. And that's part of what you were touching on earlier when we were discussing the fact that the culture itself is giving a sense of legitimacy to not only pornography, but the porn industry in general.
Yeah, and we're seeing this more and more, even on Netflix. I mean, I try not to make a habit of watching the latest Netflix series shows, because there's a lot of pornographic content in there that just wouldn't have been there 20 years ago because it's becoming so normalized. But yeah, the idea that porn can spice up your sex life, well, it'll make it more pleasurable, perhaps, But there's a difference between pleasure and intimacy. If you went out and had sex with a prostitute, that would probably be very exciting and pleasurable. But it wouldn't be intimacy. I mean, there's clearly a difference here. I've heard intimacy is explained as into me see. And the idea at that most intimate moment, I should turn my eyes away from my beloved onto a screen to watch, for the most part, I think it's fair to say, emotionally troubled women pretend to enjoy sex or be abused, and to pretend to enjoy it is not at all what intimacy is. Things can be pleasurable but deadly. If I jumped off a building, it might feel pretty bloody fun until I hit the ground, you know.
What about the addictive nature of pornography? I want you to give people a little insight on dopamine.
So dopamine is a neurotransmitter that plays a key role in the pleasure reward centers of our brain. It incentivizes us to perform actions that are conducive to our survival and that of our genes. So on a hot day, you walk inside and maybe there's a cold glass of beer or Coca-Cola. That give it to me now feeling is dopamine. Without dopamine, we wouldn't be as incentivized to eat or have sex or win a game. Sex might be as exciting as eating celery or something. It just, the species might end up dying. So that's good. Dopamine's good. But what we've discovered is when you look at pornography compulsively, a downgrading occurs. Dopamine actually begins to shrink. And then the reward center in the middle of your brain is in a state of dopamine craving, you see. It's like we've reset the pleasure thermostat in our brain and need more of that drug, whatever the drug is, and harder forms of it. And in the case of pornography, that would be more deviant forms of it in order to feel normal, aroused. And this is why people always escalate in one of two ways. They watch a lot more of porn than they used to, or they begin watching, as I said, more deviant forms of it. And why? Well, to boost the dopamine up enough so that I can feel pleasure again, because the old stuff isn't doing it anymore. So you can use the word addiction in a psychological sense, and of course there's an in-house debate among psychologists and psychiatrists as to what that means, whether it's appropriate to use it and that sort of thing. Perhaps you could use it in a theological sense. You know, you might say addiction is what happens when you bring your hunger for the infinite to a finite, mutable thing. But I'm using it in the sort of neurological sense, and that is to say, so if somebody says, well, porn can't be addictive because it's not a drug, that's hopelessly out of touch with what we know through modern neuroscience, right? Because in the DSM-5 put out by the American Psychiatric Association, they have pathological gambling as a natural addiction. I think most people would agree that that's addictive. However, nothing's ingested, nothing's injected. Well, same thing can be true with pornography. It's not about a chemical you put into your body. Natural substances such as pornography and sex and gambling can be just as addictive as external substances can. And again, that's not an excuse to hide behind the term addiction and not seek help. That doesn't mean you're not culpable for getting yourself into this addiction in the first place. But it does mean that we should have sympathy and empathy and compassion on those who are in an addictive state and seek to get them help. And saying pray harder isn't really that helpful. It would be like saying to somebody who was exhibiting signs of clinical depression, look, Philippians chapter 4, verses 4 through 8, don't you know? It says, Paul says, rejoice in the Lord always. So therefore, rejoicing is a choice and you've just got to choose it and pray more. I think most people would say, well, that's kind of irresponsible. Yeah, you ought to pray, and God wants healing for you, but that doesn't mean there aren't natural things that can help bring that about. It's like if you were hungry, you wouldn't pray to be filled if eating was an option. And so I think in addition to telling people to pray, we ought to point them to good therapists and 12-step groups and accountability partners and all sorts of practical things that without which they might not find long-lasting healing.
You know, what's interesting about that is in some fields, you can't do that. So you find behaviors that are addictive, behaviors that are detrimental to people. Right now in California, for example, there's a bill, AB 2943, and it does not allow you, if someone comes in with a sexual dysfunction, to go against the cultural narrative. And in some ways, I think we'll probably end up in the same place with respect to pornography, unless people like you get this message out through people like me and many others. I mean, this is a very significant issue we can't be silent about, and the ramifications need to be communicated. Not only the ramifications that you talked about, but you've also written in your book about erectile dysfunction. So you think about your statistic, 1992, only 5% of males age 18 to 59 had ED. In 2012, a Swiss study, 30% age 18 to 24 had ED. That is a mind blower to me, quite frankly.
Yeah, and that's why I think we should stoop to conquer. That's why, I like to call it, and I've heard this from Dr. Gail Dines, the Gulliver strategy. You know, how do you tie down the beast? Well, you bit by bit. And I think different things are going to be incentivizing to different people. So just to use an analogy again with smoking, you would think that putting a large sign on packets of cigarettes that said this will give you cancer, and in my country they actually show you, what a cancerous lung looks like or something. It's not enough. We keep buying and we keep smoking and we don't care. And so someone might say, it'll hurt your children, secondhand smoking. I don't really care. Well, I remember my mum put a sticker on my dad's workbox that said, kiss a non-smoker, enjoy the difference, all right? That might not be the most noble reason to quit smoking, but it's a reason. Let's begin wherever we can begin, right? And I think something similar with pornography. Like, I might go into an old boys' school and talk about the morality of pornography. They might not be interested. But if I tell them that their penises might not work, suddenly there's awkward silence and they'd like some more information. It doesn't mean we should stop there. I think pornography is intrinsically evil, right? So even if it wasn't addictive, even if it didn't cause erectile dysfunction, even if it didn't cause marital breakdown, I think it's wrong in and of itself because of what it is, because you shouldn't treat people merely as means to an end, especially not a selfish end. And so, but yes, I think stooping to conquer is a good idea. And so beginning with the science, this doesn't need to be a moral issue right away.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Be sure to tune in again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with author and podcaster Matt Fradd. In appreciation for your gift to help strengthen and expand the life-changing outreaches of the Christian Research Institute, Hank would like to send you The Porn Myth, exposing the reality behind the fantasy of pornography. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. There is a mysterious resonance among the structure of the material world, the abstract world of mathematics, and the human mind. This three-part harmony has major implications for the contemporary debate between naturalism and theism. The sciences alone, however, are insufficient to illuminate this enigma. Other topics include The Handmaid's Tale, Human Dignity and Hope. Slaughterhouse-Five is a tool for Christian self-examination. Redeeming Princess Culture, Five Apologetics Lessons from the Writings of Martin Luther King Jr., and much, much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today at the new discounted rate by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
A deeper understanding of the Bible's principles and truths will improve the spiritual, moral, and ethical problems facing our nation. Yet the obstacle isn't that the Bible doesn't speak to our greatest needs or answer our deepest questions. It's that the average person lacks the time and tools to extract the answers. That's why Hank Hanegraaff wrote the complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated. This expanded edition addresses over 210 of the top questions he's received as host of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Hank has taken the complex and made it simple and memorable. Receive the revised and updated Complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or visit equip.org. That's equip.org.